legislative session on the phone with a recap. And a look ahead is the managing editor of UtahPolicy.com, Brian Schott. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So I know it's you've got places to be. How much time do we have?
Just a couple of minutes. We're in the final day of committee hearings up here. We're going to be doing committee hearings all day long until about 4 o'clock when everybody hits the floor. And then it's going to be floor time all the way until sign to die on Thursday evening.
Okay. Big issues to decide or what?
Yeah, they're still working on the budget. They mostly have everything nailed down. Education is going to come out pretty well in this budget, public education. They're expecting about a 4% increase in the weighted pupil unit this year. And that translates to about $120 million in new funding for schools. Put that on top of the growth that they're going to spend for. That's about another $70 million that they're going to spend on public education. So it looks like public education is going to go around $210 million. One of the interesting things that they decided to put in the budget is lawmakers are putting in some ongoing funding. That means it should be available every single year. This year it's going to be about $8 million to pay for schoolroom supplies, so teachers won't have to pay for that out of their own pockets. You know, they are looking at some tax reform measures. It looks like the sales tax on food, at least the state portion, is going to be reinstated, but it'll be dropped a little bit down to around 4.7%. They're doing that to sort of stabilize the tax revenues. They were hoping to do some tax reform this year. Basically dropping the rate of personal income tax and also dropping the exemptions that people would have in order to help out with that. But it doesn't look like that part of tax reform is going to happen this year. So a lot of money stuff still to be done in the last couple of days up here.
Okay, real quick, I got to, just because it made me laugh out loud when I read on your report that the lawmakers pulled the plug on the bill to allow Utahns to carry a concealed weapon without a permit for an ironic reason. What happened?
Yeah, that actually goes back a couple of weeks. I was waiting to speak with Senator Kurt Bramble from Provo after floor time, and I personally witnessed him give the lobbyist for the NRA the old heave-ho out of his office. I wrote a story about it at the time. And what happened is there's a bill. Representative Lee Perry wanted to allow Utahns to carry a concealed weapon without a permit as long as there was not a round in the chamber. You could have bullets in the magazine, but not a round in the chamber. If you wanted to have a round in the chamber with a concealed weapon, you would have to get a permit. That's in state law. So he wanted to allow the carry of a concealed weapon without a round in the chamber, without a permit. The NRA didn't like that. The NRA wanted to get rid of the prohibition about having a round in the chamber. Lawmakers just got tired of them screwing with this bill over and over and over again, and they decided to just kill it for this year. Everyone I talked to said it's going to be coming back next year. They've married some domestic violence protections in the bill. But when the people behind the bill informed Governor Gary Herbert that they were going to be pulling the plug on this bill, he was genuinely shocked.
Okay. Well, we'll let you get back to work, and hopefully we check back one more time next Monday, see how things ended up. Okay. Brian Schott, the managing editor of UtahPolicy.com. Again, the final 4 days of the state legislative session counting today. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.
Legislative coverage is brought to you by Tesh Law, real estate, trusts and estates, and general litigation since 1989. TeshLaw.com.
Well, coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be talking with Alfred Knotts and Caroline Rodriguez. We've got another transit and transportation update. Park City Superintendent of Schools Ember Conley will be on the phone with us, previewing the school board meeting agenda for tomorrow morning. And finally, Tom Kelly with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association will be in with his weekly update. Stay tuned. Well, with more than $8 million in voter-approved taxes being raised every year to support new transit initiatives and improvements to our capital transportation facilities, a lot of work is being focused on unveiling some new programs. In the studio with a monthly update, I have the transportation managers for Park City, Alfred Knotts, along with Caroline Rodriguez from Summit County. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Alfred, let's just quickly begin with you, just given the amount of interest I've seen over the start of apparently paid parking in China Bridge. We have heard people throwing asking me if it's going to start June 1. What's the deal?
Right now we have an RFP out that closes, which is a request for proposals. This is for the actual technology that closes on the 17th of March. That is on our website. I don't know anybody really wants to read a parking RFP, but it is there if people would like to delve into that. That really will dictate the schedule. We're still shooting for some infrastructure to be installed during the spring and early summer also. So it'll be kind of a soft rollout. We're going to work on the wayfinding, which is what's going to tell people, you know, what's available, how to access the parking. And then the pricing structure will be kind of fluid and iterative as we work through kind of the kinks. We want to make sure we get it right. We want to work with the community and work with the HPCA also.
But we should give heads up then to people that China Bridge may, I mean, it's been free parking for, well, since it started. So it eventually may be paid parking.
Correct.
At least during busy times of the day.
Yes, during busy times. It's really an overall parking management strategy and transportation demand management strategy. It's a part of a larger project, really, in the whole overall system. The county's working right now to potentially convert the Ecker View area into remote parking. We're still working to get the Richardson Flat parking ride online as well and have transit service all out there. And then also there's an additional UDOT parcel on the frontage road that the county and the city are working with UDOT on potentially constructing additional remote parking. So that's kind of how all the system is tied together.
All right. And we have transit planner Kinsey coming in later on in the week, and she can tell us a lot more about just the parking management.
Correct.
Program.
Once the RFP closes out, that'll really dictate the schedule from going forward at that point. So that'll really lay out the technology and the service provider. There's really only a handful of people that do this. Kinsey's actually at a parking conference right now, and she's coming back with additional information and meeting with vendors there also.
All right. So, Caroline, one of the ways that we can save on parking will be the e-bike program that Summit County is going to be rolling out this spring.
June.
Okay.
We had a certain amount of lead time to order the bikes because they actually have to be manufactured for us. So June 2017 is our ideal launch date.
So the county council last week looked at the ordinance governing e-bikes. Mm-hmm. Where are we with that?
So the council asked us to go back and work with Park City to ensure that we actually need an ordinance. Do we really need an ordinance, or do we really just need posted speed limits? I think Roger and the rest of the council was concerned that we would put an ordinance into effect that A, wasn't necessary, and B, was difficult and expensive to enforce. So we're going back, you know, because we want to make sure we're consistent city and county, because, you know, nobody sees those lines. So we're going to go back and work with Alfred and Heinrich and Bob Radke at Base and Rec and make sure that this is what we want to do, and make sure that if we do put an ordinance into effect, it's effective and meets our needs.
Yeah. But what we have talked about is whether or not these are legal outside of the paved 8-foot wide trails. So how do you enforce them from not being used on dirt single track?
Well, that's the crux of the issue. I mean, how do we enforce? Enforcement costs money and staff time. And, you know, my view is that it's more of social norms and the other riders on the track enforcing it and giving you that look when you know you're not supposed to be there and they know you're not supposed to be there. And, you know, I think our community is really understanding in that sense, and nobody wants to be an inconsiderate rider.
All right. And in terms of where these e-bikes go, do you have that plan?
Yep. We have 9 total stations, 4 in the county, 1 midway at Canyon's base, and then 4 in the city. So in the county, it's the new Whole Foods location, Tanger, Kimball Junction Transit Center, and New Park. And in the city, those locations are?
Prospector Square, Town Lift, or Fresh Market. In the Old Town Transit Center, and then we're also looking at the library also, and that's the initial rollout. Something to kind of keep in mind is we're trying to develop these alternatives and provide alternatives such as the e-bikes and the express route service from Kimball and other programs and guaranteed ride-home programs in advance of the paid parking also. So all this does tie together, and we want to make sure we give employees, residents, people coming down for events that they either have the alternatives, and just our free transit is a huge alternative also.
Yeah, so at these stations, you'd walk up to one and put a credit card in and then right away?
So that will be one of the options. We'll also have, you can register online and you'll probably get a key fob, and your key fob then unlocks the bike, so you really don't have to mess with the kiosks on site. We will also have two other options for our residents that may be underbanked, and that is they can pay cash to a technician on the street, or they can go to any 7-Eleven and pay cash onto their account. And then that will credit their key fob.
All right. So you have to pay in advance?
Yes.
All right. And then it's just whatever. And it's charged, what, per minute, per
hour? So that is to be determined. We'll have the vendor on site for a week in March, and that's one of the things we'll be talking about. Likely will be an annual membership for our residents, and then also a weekly or hourly pass if that's what you choose to do.
All right. Any idea? I mean, can you give us a ballpark figure?
Well, I can say in some other areas, you know, annual memberships are as low as $80 a year. And, you know, that's for incidental use. And I can say that the fares will be commensurate with our free transit system because it's all part of the same system. So we don't want to make fares so high that people say, well, I'm not going to use it then.
Yeah. So $80 as much use as you want then?
So in other areas that have that $80 fee, they have the $80 annual, and then you can use the bikes for 1 to 2 hours at a time. And then if you go over that, then you pay the hourly. But, you know, most of these trips are going to be 30-minute trips.
Right. And so you when you put the bike back in, you use your fob to lock it back up?
It automatically locks in. You hear it click closed when it locks.
All right. And then it recharges right then.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay. How many bikes are you going to have at different at the nine stations?
88 bikes to start.
All right. And then what happens if they all end up at the library? You just have...
So that's actually one of the great things about our vendor is that part of it is that we will have on-the-street staff that rebalance the bikes. So we track them on the back end through their GPS. And if we see that there's 9 bikes at the library, then somebody goes out with a trailer and moves them to where they belong.
So unlike rental cars, one-way trips are okay here.
Correct.
All right. Let's see. 248. What's the update on this?
248. We are getting that onto the UDOT choke point list. Right now, it's not programmed for any state dollars or federal dollars, but it is one of our high priority projects with the propositions that were passed. So we are going to advance some of the design work and get some of the survey work and other field work done during the summer and then queue that up for UDOT's state and federal funding. So it's going to be a I won't say a long process, but once we get the ball rolling, we're going to phase the project from logical limits, being US 40 to Wyatt Earp, and then Wyatt Earp to Bonanza, and then Bonanza to 224. So we'll be able to construct the project in phases and address the major choke point as the first priority, and that would be at the Narrows.
But we already have 2 lanes in each direction from where? From Sidewinder, yeah?
Yes. They don't meet the state standards, so there's still recovery zones that need to be constructed. The bike lanes we want to keep maintained through that corridor also. And then as we move down the corridor, there's still drainage improvements, and it's not as simple as just a restriping exercise, but there's a full reengineering that needs to take place for that road to function as a state highway.
Yeah. Do you have a ballpark estimate on what we're talking about here?
Right now we have a high-level number, and that's from the UDOT plan, and it's between $11 and $15 million. But as we get through the design and we get through the environmental, we'll be able to drill down that number to a more concrete number and reduce that contingency also.
Yeah, so that could take about 3 years of the tax funding right there, huh?
It could. And, you know, that's why we're making sure that we're working very well with the county and then making sure that the priority projects on 224 and other improvements that are regionally significant are also lined up for that funding as well.
So what would you do, bond for it and then just pay it back with the tax?
That's the potential. There's also the potential that as we advance the design work for UDOT, that they will apply that to our match and we can get an 80% return our investment with other federal dollars also. So since it is a choke point project, that puts it up on higher on the UDOT list. So we've advocated for that, and they've been very receptive to that also.
So would we see any construction start this summer?
The only opportunity to maybe do some construction is we're doing a separate effort for the existing at-grade crossing from the seminary to the school and seeing if we could advance that this summer as part of the tunnel project, because the tunnel is a component of the overall project, but it has independent utility, so we might be able to advance that project before we do the whole project for 248.
Church putting some money in then to that?
I'm actually meeting with them today to have that discussion.
All right. And then finally, construction with regard to 224. What are we going to see there, Caroline?
It's actually 248.
Oh,
Yep, and I'm glad you did ask about construction because it's a pretty significant project. Starting May 1st, UDOT is going to be reconstructing 248 from the 7-Eleven in Camas all the way down to Park City Hospital area. There are going to be lane closures and flagging. UDOT has graciously agreed to keep the road open for our major holidays, Memorial Day, 4th of July, Pioneer Day, also Camas Fiesta Days and the Tour of Utah. So they know about some of our major events. But I do want our citizens to be aware that there is going to be flagging in both directions on 248. Now, as part of our mitigation for that, we are trying to get our Camas commuter bus service put in place. And we have an agreement with UDOT that they will allow the bus to come through the flagging once they see it. So potentially, if you're on the bus riding from Camas, you would get through quicker than you would in your vehicle alone. In addition to that, if you're coming from the Rock Cliff area, be aware that at the same time UDOT is doing 248, they're also rehabbing the pavement between Rock Cliff and Camas. So you could potentially be in construction your entire commute.
Okay. Caroline, Alfred, anything else that you wanted to mention?
Actually, I did receive an email this morning from UDOT also on 224 that we'll be doing a one lane closure northbound by Meadows Drive. I don't know what the weather is going to do that, if they're still going to proceed with it, but plan on that being the case all week.
Okay. Hey, we'll see you next month. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Caroline Rodriguez and Alfred Knotts. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Park City Board of Education meeting in a special regular session tomorrow morning starting at 9 at the school district office on Kearns Boulevard. On the phone, Superintendent of Schools Amber Conley. Good morning, Amber.
Morning, Leslie.
First up, a discussion about the timeline for grade realignment. So what's the plan? We're moving forward with the 2018-19 school year?
Right. So what we did was start the implementation plan with the possible decision of 2018-19. The board still has to decide upon that, but it was a request from the board to have an implementation plan and just to show to the public that we definitely do have a plan in place.
All right. But don't we need to make some other decisions first, like where do we put the ninth graders, since any high school expansion would not be done by then?
Right. So what we're asking the board is to be able to come to consensus to move forward with facilities and ideally, of course, having the facilities in place for grade realignment. Again, this is something the board's going to have to examine all of the information, take into account their constituents, and then, of course, our staff and most importantly, our student needs.
So there will be a discussion following that about financing strategies for the high school expansion. This is just a decision. When does the board actually take a vote?
There is some deadlines that the board is very aware of, and that is we have to have if we were to go to bond, we need to have the language in place 70 days prior to the election, which is around August. And so then when you backtrack that decision, we are nearing the need to have the decision just to be able to have the information out to the public, to be able to provide all the details for our taxpayers.
So how many options are we talking about? Again, the 3A, 4A, and possibly a new high school?
So what we have done is, if you recall, the board previously asked us to put together some options for the high school expansion using the current high school facility, and that's what the committee has provided. We have a 3A and 4A, which we've had a robust input process for that. And as the board has discussed that and the numbers have come out as far as how much does this expansion cost currently, 3A is coming in around $63 million and 4A is coming in around $65 million. Then the discussion among the board, a couple of the board members, was, are there other possibilities for a high school? And that's certainly something that we've been planning. The second high school that's supposed to come on board as far as the master planning is anywhere from 10 to 15 years out. But that is something the board has asked us to look at, and we are doing that.
Well, I see that you're also meeting in a closed session to discuss what's listed as the purchase, exchange, or lease of real property. So I'm guessing this may have to do with property for the high school?
You know, we have definitely been in conversations with, the city, with the county. We have great partnerships with the city and the county staff, as well as having some discussions with some neighboring school districts. So I think it's a fun time. It's exciting, but it's also we're in a time crunch. We have needs for our students for their learning environment.
Well, Park City and Summit County jointly own what's known as the Triangle property. That's along U.S. 40, about 112 acres. Is that a possibility?
You know, in talking with South Summit, and I know you're very aware of this, they're looking at expanding their high school. They have a need for a high school and a middle school. And at any given time, with the expansion of that area, they could be needing another elementary. So we're looking at opportunities. We've been in conversations with them. Nothing public yet, but you know, we're discussing and exploring.
Also, a report from Todd Hansen about the capital outlay projects that'll need to be done this coming year, mostly this summer. The packet didn't contain that list of projects, but can you identify maybe the big ones, especially those related to Treasure Mountain?
Right. So there's not anything big, you know, over $1 million with Treasure. We do have some cleaning of the filters. So coming into the building, we had all of the filters going from the building into the classroom done last year. And so now it's time to clean the filters from coming outside directly into the first infiltration system. We have to do some carpet cleaning and some carpet repair and possibly replacement along the hallways in the high traffic areas. And all of the rest of them, we do have some possible portables that we're looking at, both for McPullen, and there was a request for Treasure. But, again, we'll be presenting all of that to the board later tomorrow.
Yeah. Any idea how much we need to put into Treasure to make it safe or otherwise functional?
Right. So, first of all, it's functional now. And I would say right now it looks about $300,000 for this summer work. And again, that's the filtering system and cleaning of the carpets and replacing.
All right. Let's see. A couple of decisions are also scheduled for tomorrow. So if we haven't decided on an expansion versus building a new school, and we really don't know how to pay for either of them yet, so why do we need to make a decision on portable classrooms?
One of the things that we have been working on at McPullen, and we are the only school-wide dual-language immersion school in the state now, and with that model, having what we call a four-section model, meaning that there's four sections starting first grade all the way through fifth grade. We started that this last year with the exception of fifth grade, and so we are in need of continuing that model because we have fourth graders now following the four-section model, meaning that there's both a class of about 75 to 100 students that are going back and forth with the dual language. So we do need to have two additional classrooms at McPullen this next year, regardless of what happens with the high school or the 5-6.
Okay. Let's see. Also a scheduled to make a decision on the bond timeline. Now, is this just the decision to bond with a price tag to be determined?
You know, there's a lot of different ways that school districts bond now. Some in the past, you might be aware that they have a rough estimate of the bond's going to be X amount of dollars. And now, given the current, I'm going to say the environment across the entire United States is, you know, the public demands more details. And so with that, that was one of the reasons that we went into a lot of detail with the high school expansion. When you get into an elementary school, they're more, I'm going to use the word cookie cutter type schools. However, we do need to have the location specified because that does get into the design of the school. With your question circling back of don't we need to have the amount, you can go one, you know, you don't have to have the exact amount to bond because it's for 10 years to have that bond authority. But that's something, again, that the board is really interested in and making sure that we have a really great process and information out to the public.
So I guess I'm a little bit unclear. So you're telling me that you do not have to, if in fact that you were to hold a bond election, you don't need to have an amount for that bond?
You have to have a rough amount, you know, but as far as like having every detail, you don't. So let's just say we're estimating with the high school, and I'm really pulling these numbers out of the air. These are not numbers that we're using. But let's just say it's $120 million that we estimate to do everything we need to do. The board can bond for that authority and then go back and do phases. It does require specific language in the law to have the project determined. So, for instance, the project would be the high school, a 5-6 school, and possibly a McPullen expansion. So, again, those would have to be determined, but the amounts do not.
All right, so you would
that,
not...
I'm not saying that that's what the board's going to do. I'm just saying that that is within legal boundaries.
Got it. But you couldn't throw other projects in there.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. Let's see. So that decision is scheduled to be made, whether or not to bond this year or not then, huh?
You know, any time on an agenda that there's a decision, it does provide the board the opportunity to make a decision. That can always be tabled to a later date. This is a work session, but these are the questions that the board has continued to ask in their board meetings and has asked administration to bring information back, and that's what we're doing.
All right. And you're also going to have some figures from Todd Hauber, right? I mean, he'll give us an idea of different bond levels and what people can expect to pay versus increasing the property tax, the capital levy, right?
Right. So part of the discussion that he has is when you look at the financing strategies, which is on the agenda of 3.02, there's a tax impact calculator that allows the board to put in different amounts and see what the impact would be on property.
All right. School start times. When does that decision get made?
Right. So where we are in the process has been that we hired a transportation consultant back in January, and the draft report or findings should be ready by tomorrow. Again, we're waiting on them, but the final report will be done by the end of March, and so that really is dependent on what they're seeing. I can tell you from what I know is that we have a new transportation director. There has been some growth that we need to address as far as areas of weakness that we need to address, and we're glad that we have a new director at the helm to be able to make those changes.
Finally, any legislative issues out there that are of concern to you? I know you got some good news last week with an increase of 4% in the WPU.
We do, and I have to say, I just returned back from the National Conference of Education, which is the largest conference for superintendents in public education, and listening to what other states are having to go through versus what we're doing here in Utah, we're very, very fortunate, excited to see what the legislation is doing, and even more so that there's a belief that education is extremely important within our state for our economic development. So good news for us.
All right, Amber, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher in the studio now with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association, Tom Kelly. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie. Boy, it was so nice to get back this weekend after 3 weeks on the road and make some nice turns at both Park City and Deer Valley. Great to see the snow here.
Yeah, you spent some time in Finland, so let's get the recap then on the cross-country World Championships.
Boy, what an amazing World Championships it was. A lot of records set up there and a great World Championship celebrating, interestingly enough, the 100th anniversary of Finland as a country. So about 250,000 fans packed the stands. We had 35,000 one day for the skiathlon event. And for the USA, it was an interesting feeling because we went into these championships with the Scandinavians and some of the other favorites in cross country actually looking for us as favorites in different events. We kicked it off in fine style in the opening day as we reported last week, with Jesse Diggins and Keegan Randall taking silver and bronze in the freestyle sprint to open things up. And then a few days later, we struck medals again, this time with Jesse Diggins and Sadie Bjornsson coming through and taking the bronze medal in the classic. team sprint. And what was really important about that is the first time ever that the U.S. has medaled in the classic discipline in modern days. So a really, really big step. Jesse also came out and was fifth in the 30K freestyle event. And the U.S. women, interestingly enough, going into the relay as one of the most feared teams by the Swedes and some of the others, but unfortunately coming away with another fourth-place finish, third straight Worlds. We've been fourth, but definitely up skiing with the big girls, but not quite able to turn it into medals. But a whole different attitude right now with the rest of the world, looking at the USA as a cross-country power of sorts, particularly on the women's side. They will be in Drummond, Norway for a classic town sprint on Wednesday this week, and then on to Oslo for distance racing this weekend. And then the World Cup finals, originally scheduled for Russia, have been moved to Quebec City, a move the FIS made in January to, in response to the doping issue, to move the World Cup finals out of Russia into Quebec City. So it's kind of a home field advantage for us. We get extra quota spots and anxious to take those, and that'll be coming up, unfortunately, the same time as the Aspen World Cup finals, but 17th and 19th of March.
All right, let's move on to the Alpine World Cup. What have we got going there?
Olympic test event for the women over in Pyeongchang at the downhill and Super-G in Yongsan. Very, very successful. Everybody loves that race course, which is actually being prepared by Tommy Johnston from our organization, who's been living and working over there as the snow control manager. So for the USA, Lindsey Vonn, second in two events. She lost out on the win by 700s in the downhill, 400s in the Super-G. Sofia Goggia from Italy, finally putting together a couple of really good runs to take the wins. And Ilka Stuich, who's going to ultimately, we think, take both the downhill and the Super-G World Cup titles, picking up the third-place finishes. Loren Ross finishing fourth in the downhill. So ultimately, really good feelings about that course. Lindsey, a little disappointed she didn't get those two wins, but very, very happy with her performance. She skied at top form, no issue with the hand that's hampered her a lot during World Championships.
All right, World Cup finals coming to Aspen too.
Yeah, we got a great swing coming right now. This Friday and Saturday, we will be in Squaw Valley for a GS and a slalom on Red Dog. A fantastic event shaping up there. Michaela Schifrin with an opportunity to clinch the World Cup slalom title on Saturday. You can watch those races on NBCSN. And then things swing over to Aspen for the World Cup finals. This is an amazing event with all of the top racers in the world. The overall title is still up for grabs a little bit. Michaela has a commanding lead right now, but Ilka Stuich certainly challenging her. Michaela will not ski the downhill at Aspen, but she will ski the Super-G, and that's kind of the day we're looking that she could potentially clinch the overall title. If not, she'll take it into the weekend and hopefully do it in the slalom or the GS. But a good opportunity for her right now with a 168-point lead over Ilka Stuich.
Okay, and then finally, we've got the freestyle and free skiing and snowboarding World Championships. They're off to Spain?
Yeah, we've been doing World Championships now for the past like 6 weeks, and we still have two more weeks to go. Freestyle is up this week in Sierra Nevada, Spain. Moguls on Wednesday, dual moguls Thursday, and hitting the aerials on Friday. Jonathan Lillis was fourth in Moscow over the weekend in the final World Cup. And then next week, we switch things over to free skiing and snowboarding in Sierra Nevada. Big shout out to McCray Williams from Park City. He was second at Korvach and Silva Plana, Switzerland this past weekend, and that gave him the World Cup slopestyle title. But big events coming up over the next few weeks as we wrap up what has been a very successful season.
Okay, Tom, see you next week.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Tom, 8:53 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio, hydrologist with the National Weather Service, Brian McInerney. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Leslie. How are you?
Doing well. So it's back to winter again today. Yep. And spring just around the corner.
Yeah, and it's great. We've got a foot of snow on the mountain as of last night, about 8 o'clock. And it looks like it's going to continue. We're going to warm up a little bit this week. But really, overall, we're doing quite well. We're at 150% to 160% of average snowpack here and on the front side down in Alta. And so when you look at the ski industry, this has been a great year compared to where we were the last 5 years. This is exceptional. Well, we've seen the weather patterns. We haven't seen that high-pressure ridge. We did see it for a brief period, which was a little scary in February. We warmed up to about 23 degrees above average. We had rain up to 9,000 feet. And we thought we were going to maybe go in the tank like we did the year before. But it didn't happen. It turned cold again. We did see a lot of basement flooding and things like that in northern Utah with the warm-up. And unfortunately, it's what we're going to see more of as we just continue with a warming climate. We're going to see more of these warm-ups and rain events during our meteorological winter. But fortunately for us, that shifted around. We're back into the cold systems coming out of the Pacific Northwest. These other systems were called atmospheric rivers, where they came out by Hawaii. They were warm, really wet. But unfortunately, if you were in a lower elevation, you got a lot of rain. Whereas now we're back into the storms out of the Pacific Northwest, out of Alaska, and that's what's causing all this good snow we've got right now.
You know, so last fall when we were looking at this, I mean, had you predicted a La Nina or an El Nino?
You know, we didn't, because the La Nina we have is really weak. So statistically, it doesn't really have any correlation between long-range forecasting. What we did look at, though, is the position of these really cold pools of air that you typically see. And when you look over the Hudson Bay, there's a Hudson Bay low that's positioned, which put us in the high pressure. It's like a sine wave over the west. Well, in October, they noticed it wasn't there anymore. Where the cold pool was over Siberia and parts of Alaska. So that shifted. It's like rocks in a river where the jet stream goes. And for us, they thought this could be seasonally like we saw back in the late 90s. And then we were 5 years of below average precipitation. Typically, we switch from wet to dry to wet. And it did. It changed. And now we've got snowpacks that are larger than 2011 and 2005, which are the biggest years we've had around here for quite some time. So the next question is how is this going to come off? Are we going to have flooding? And most likely we're going to have problems in some areas, but it'll all depend on how it comes off. And for the ski industry, if it just keeps going, that's just great.
Yeah, so the 50-degree temperatures that we've got coming later this week, is that normal or is that, again, above average?
It's above average, and that's what we're seeing. We're above average on the whole for these last 2 months, but until we get a storm that comes through and makes things much colder. The air mass comes from Alaska. It swoops down at us, makes things a lot colder. But when you go back to just what we typically see without any big cold fronts moving through, we're warmer than average, and we're going to see that later in the week.
Yeah. So the ideal situation is that temperatures just hover 40 degrees through May.
Right. And if you're still into skiing, it'd be colder than normal. More systems coming out of the Pacific Northwest, so it's light snow and not that heavy rain that we saw when it comes out of Hawaii. And that's what we see right now. And we'd like to see these storms go all the way through April, and then we'll see how it goes as far as water supply.
Yeah. So as a hydrologist, that's really what you're most interested in is how much water we have in the snowpack, and it seems like a lot.
A lot. 1.5 times what you typically have for this time of year. And I think as the hydrologist, you look at two ways. Water supply, and that's great. We're going to fill the reservoirs except for the really large ones, and then we'll see. But with that comes a price that if we melt all at once in late May and we turn the switch and we do get a really rapid warming, we could see some pretty damaging flood events during late May and early June, but that's yet to be seen. That's kind of far out.
And are we seeing this statewide? I mean, down south as well?
Yeah. When you look at Utah, we're doing much better than most of the West as far as snow accumulation compared to average. So we'll take that, and it's all good news.
Yeah. Lake Powell, though, won't get filled.
No, Lake Powell may never fill again, actually, due to how they manage it. So that's a sad story.
All right. Hey, Brian, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPC.